This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, it's Health and Living on the Bigger Picture. I'm Tina Camellia, and in the studio with me this week is Live and Learn producer Chua Untak.
Hello.
Hi. So, as usual, for our Health News Digest every week, we cover some of the topics that we find interesting or that caught our attention, and we figured that we might as well share it with everyone and you know, have some discussions around it. The first topic of this week, Untak?
What caught my eye was something happened across the causeway. A personal trainer named Zemet Neo, I'm not sure if I got his first name right, was recently crowned the champion of the inaugural Food League Singapore eating contest. What struck, I think, your attention as well is the fact that the winner is a fitness professional. In fact, not many competitive eaters are physically big. So how many calories did he eat in that one sitting? We're going to, I think, cover the amount of food he ate in that competition. How much sugar and trans fat did he have to consume? And what does competitive eating do to your body? It's very popular in the US and Japan, I think. I guess it's coming now to Singapore.
Yeah. And the second story we would cover is virtual reality and health. And I think this is a big topic. Virtual reality itself is kind of huge, not just in the healthcare industry, but I think gaming industry.
And roller coaster, is that?
I think entertainment, it's mainly in entertainment, but it's also being used in healthcare and hospitals, especially in the UK and the US. They're taking the lead in this, in turning to simulation and to the virtual world to train healthcare professionals in medical procedures, but they're also using VR to treat patients for conditions ranging from stroke to mental health and even childbirth. So we're going to cover some of these smaller stories under the whole umbrella of virtual reality and health. Now, on the topic of what's real and what's not, our third story is
fake health news. So the terms fake news and post-fact world or post-truth were popular phrases last year, but were used mainly when discussing politics. Health news have also its fair share of false news perpetrated, especially on Facebook, by personalities like David Wolf, The Food Babe, and even Gwyneth Paltrow. This I did not know. Why are they so influential, and what does this mean? What can we trust and what can we not trust? How do we discern what's true and what's not? I don't know, Tina.
We're trying our best with shows like this. So join in the conversation. If you have any opinions about any of these topics, you can tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp or text us 016-201-9000, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, it's Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Tina Camellia. In the studio with me, Chua Untak, Live and Learn producer. We're discussing some of the health news or health-related topics that caught our attention. Today, we are starting off with competitive eating because a personal trainer, Zemet Neo, was just crowned the champion of the inaugural Food League Singapore Eating Contest. And this topic kind of is a personal interest of Untak, I just recently found out. Tell me more about this competitive eating.
Well, I always thought I could eat a lot, but when I saw how much this guy was eating, I'm nowhere near that. He ate like 92 chicken wings in 8 minutes. He has very, very interesting eating techniques, and I think I've read of similar feats before as well in the past of how they have to soak bread in water, for example, mm-hmm. To shove it down your throat. But I'm not exactly sure on the science, but I think it's not healthy. Like the amount of food that they are eating, was there any safety precaution taken? Was there any medical personnel at the competition? Mm-hmm. I think these are what we're going to explore, right?
Yeah. And I did a quick search online to find out how many calories 92 chicken wings is equivalent to. It's 8,464 calories.
Oh my God.
So that's like...
What's the normal calorie intake per day?
I think on average about 2,000 to 3,000. I think for women, 2,000-ish. For men, 3,000. So that's about three times more of our daily caloric intake.
Right.
And his winning technique for eating the chicken wing, according to him...
What you do is, you hold one end of the wing, you hold it really, like, you know, really hold it, and you tuck it, and make it like a little meat umbrella.
So it involved cracking one end of the wing, sliding the flesh downwards to form a meat umbrella, and then shoving the meat into his mouth.
He didn't win it by much either, because the second place winner, her name is Sarah Au, and she's a flight attendant. So, and she finished 88 wings in the same time as Neo, who finished 92. So, wow.
I tried to look up Sarah Au and find out more about her. She apparently is not a newcomer to this as well, at least in Singapore. I think the two personalities when it comes to competitive eating are both of them. They've always been known to be neck and neck when it comes to competitions like this. And she's also featured in a viral video last month, downing 8 bowls of lor mee in 17 minutes. And I find that very fascinating because if you don't know what lor mee is, it's actually thick, starchy gravy with thick yellow noodles. And she ate 8 of that.
Right. Wouldn't she burn her tongue or something?
I don't know. She, of course, I have to find out how many calories that amounted to. A bowl is 383 calories average. So that means she ate 3,086 calories in that one sitting.
So that's part of the, I guess, news appeal of eating competition, right? The winners aren't usually big people. They are slim or sometimes slightly underweight as well. The current world number one is Matt Stoney. He weighs only 54 kg for someone who is 5 feet 8. That is about 175 centimeters.
I've been a competitor for about the past four and a half years, ever since I was 19 years old. I think right now I hold 12 world records. It's adding up over the past few years, but everything from like gyros to Japanese dumplings, pumpkin pie, Twinkies, you name it. It started kind of as a fluke, you know. I was in college, there was a contest nearby, a lobster roll contest. They said, you know, eat as many lobster rolls as you can for free, and if you win, eat the most lobster rolls, you get $1,000. So I ended up winning the contest, pocketing $1,000, and I was just like, hey, this is not that bad. You know, a lot of the competitors up on stage, you know, they're not big guys. They're not heavy set guys like you'd think, because it's a 10-minute sprint when you go up there. And, you know, I'm doing my cardio, I'm doing my weights. I'm no Superman or anything, you know. It's a pretty normal diet, especially around contest time. You know, I'm cutting back. I'm eating pretty minimal between practices and whatnot. But, you know, like in the off season, I'm just a normal guy, just eating normal food.
Normal guy eating normal food. Sounds like you, Antek. I know you have a big appetite. I've seen you eat.
Right.
You sit right across me in this office. I thought you're a big eater, but nothing compared to them.
Correct. I think I eat smaller portions, but just more frequently. Yeah, so I guess the similarity end in the fact that we have about the same physique. Once we move past that, is it actually healthy to eat that much or so much? Is it safe?
So not much research has been done about competitive eating, but several doctors from the University of Pennsylvania in the US did an experiment for a National Geographic special, and they compared two men, a champion eater and one non-competitive eating man who simply had a healthy appetite. So he's kind of the control experiment. And the men were asked to consume as many hot dogs as they could in 12 minutes. And the researchers noted that after eating the hot dogs, the competitive eater's stomach appeared as a massively distended, food-filled sac occupying most of the upper abdomen. And what I find interesting about this is that if you look at a lot of the professional competitive eaters, they actually have six-pack abs. And then it just swells at the end of the competition. And so according to the doctors, there was little or no gastric peristalsis. Peristalsis is the squeezing motion to help break the food down and move it down the gastrointestinal chain. And the competitive eater was also able to overcome the satiety reflex to accept an unlimited amount of food. So normally for regular folks like you and I, we have satiety reflex to tell us, okay, we're full, we're going to stop eating because otherwise we're just going to throw up.
Right.
But they managed to bypass that brain pathways and just keep on eating.
Yeah, why would someone want to do that? Is it pleasurable to go way past that threshold?
I don't think it's pleasurable. I think the first bowl of whatever they're eating is fun. And then afterwards, it's just about glory. I need to win this. It's pride and glory.
Yeah, there's probably no taste in the hot dogs that they have to eat as well.
Yeah, especially when you're dipping it in water, it's smushed and you're not chewing much either because you're just shoving it down your throat.
Yeah, and the amount of training they have to go through in order to go for a competition, I wonder whether they still have pleasure when they eat their meals. What do they do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. So the Major League Eating, which is the world body that oversees all professional eating contests, places a high priority on safety, according to the chair, George Shea. He says that emergency medical technicians are present at all official contests. I tried to look into some of the known or high-level competitions patients. There's never been actually a medical emergency, so we don't know what kind of actual medical emergency they would have faced with if it were to happen. So no one really knows exactly how, when you overstretch your stomachs the way that these competitive eaters do, how that will affect them years down the line. But the researchers who did that study with Nat Geo, they predicted some consequences. They said that if the stomach stretches enough, it can't get back to its original size, then this could cause intractable nausea and vomiting, which makes it necessary for them to have a partial or total gastrectomy to relieve the symptoms and restore their ability to eat.
Sounds like a rubber band, isn't it? You stretch it too much, then it can't go back to its original size. I guess what we're waiting to find out, because this is a relatively new field, a new competition, wondering whether or not the rubber band would eventually break. If it breaks, then I guess then people would stop competitive eating.
The champions are trained to avoid getting sick, but for everyone else, I guess we should not try this at home. We'll be back with more health stories like this. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, it's Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Tina Carmelia. In the studio with me, Chua Untek, Live and Learn producer. He joins me today as we discuss some of the health news that were interesting in our opinions. And if you have any thoughts about it, feel free to participate in the conversation. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can text or WhatsApp us 016-201-9000. Our next story is about virtual reality and health. So that's a sampling of what Erin Matucci may have experienced while giving birth. It's the sound of a campfire by the beach. But she was not on vacation. She was actually in the hospital. So UK and US hospitals have been using virtual reality to train healthcare professionals in medical procedures. They're also using it to treat patients, including when patients are giving birth.
So last month, The Guardian reported that Erin became the first woman to use VR alone without drugs for pain management during labour. Her virtual experience was peppered with instructions like focus on the birds, remember to breathe, delivered by a pre-recorded narrator.
And this month, BBC reported that VR also helped a 17-year-old Shannon Mackey to walk again.
Waking up in the middle of the night, wanted to go to the toilet, and I couldn't get up. And the reason being is that I'd had a stroke in the night. And I went into hospital at Soft Royal, and I remember being in there, and a doctor suggested to me that I'd be over at a basic centre. And I never had, my mum had heard of it.
So she was to have her last radiotherapy session to remove a brain tumour when she suffered a stroke, which left her wheelchair-bound and unable to use her left side of her body. And in addition to traditional physiotherapy sessions, she attended virtual reality sessions at the Brain and Spinal Injury Centre in the UK. And 2 years later, she has regained motion in her arms and is once again able to walk without any aid. The VR system consists of a harness, treadmill and motion trackers, she explained.
I go on to the cavern and then we do all types of like different kind of activity games almost, which kind of build up my strength of my leg and my arms. I'm 19 now, I'm still walking, so it's just, I feel like it's helped so much. It's been hard, but I feel like I always try to see the positive side of it. I mean, if I didn't try, if I didn't come here, I don't think I'd be where I am today.
Have you experienced virtual reality, Antek?
I think on those theme park rides that take you into space to create stuff that you just can't create with, to go into space, I think, would cost too much for me.
Yeah,
so that's the best I can do.
Yeah, I think those 4D rides, they call it, right? I mean, I've experienced something like, you know, your chair shaking and then you have splashes of water and all that kind of stuff. That's the closest I've been to virtual reality simulation. It's almost very real, except that, you know, like when you put on the harness and when you put on your eye goggles thing, you know that it's not real. But then when you experience it, when the whole ride is being played, you feel like, oh,
I wonder whether movies are considered virtual reality. Does it have to involve interaction, or is it the immersive experience that counts?
That's actually a good point. I think it really depends on the point of why you're doing it. I suppose some people are just fine being immersed in the experience. Some people probably expect a lot more interaction than just being there.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Because I think the New York Times has this new feature called the 360, where you get to go into a location like a war zone, for example. And what they do is you get to circle around and see your surroundings as you read the text that's been written. So you not only read what happened, you get to see what happened. Or they'll guide you through the narrative through the perspective of someone who was quoted in the story.
Mm-hmm. I've watched one about a mental health institution in Venezuela, if I'm not mistaken. And it's a very run-down institution, and you hear people screaming and yelling in one corner while the narrator tries to tell a story about this person's history and the backstory. It's quite immersive. It's also, you can't help but stare. And I feel like if it's in real life, you would be a little bit more tactful about staring. But when you know it's virtual reality, you can stare as long as you want. But at the same time, you also feel like it's, what's the word, intrusive.
Right.
You feel like, is this still intrusive or no? Because do they know or do they not know?
Correct. And for virtual reality to work, I think you have to suspend disbelief, right? Because otherwise it won't work. Your brain is not being tricked into whatever that you need to achieve, the purpose of doing the virtual reality in the first place.
And going back to the story of the childbirth using VR and how that has been used to manage pain, I think it's quite interesting that when virtual reality is real enough to the person experiencing it, that you can completely ignore real pain that's actually happening in real life and then pretend that you're in a beach somewhere and then have a pain-free childbirth without any drugs to help with the pain management. And research have shown that VR increases people's threshold for pain by distracting them. A paper in the Clinical Journal of Pain reported 11 burn patients immersed in VR for half the time period of their treatment, and they all reported a significant drop in pain while in VR. And of course, virtual simulations have also been used for medical students to practice procedures and gain confidence faster. You can also be transported into the operating theatre to watch an operation. For example, in April last year, the first of such surgery took place in Royal London Hospital, where doctors gave global access into the operating theatre as they removed cancerous cells from a 17-year-old British man with colon cancer. I don't know whether I want to watch that. Would you want to watch that?
Well, what was the context of this event, though? Was it for entertainment? Was it for educational purposes? Because if it's for medical students, then I can imagine how it would be very useful, because the operating room would have limited capacity, right, for the number of students who can attend. But for entertainment purposes, I don't know how I would feel if I was the person being operated on to have the insides of my body visible to anyone who has a curiosity or interest in how surgery works.
And I think part of the reason they're doing this is also to experiment with the idea of maybe allowing the patient's families to see what's going on as it's going on, so that they're not waiting outside the operating theatre not knowing what's going on. I think it's supposed to help them relax and be like, okay, the doctor has this under control. I worry that if something does happen in the operating theatre, if things go wrong, then it will also cause a lot of panic.
Correct.
So I don't really know. I mean, I think there's a lot of discussions around ethics, for example, whether it's just creating this culture of being too intrusive. I think that that's also pointless. I wouldn't find this entertaining at all. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I wouldn't find it entertaining, but that's because I have an aversion towards blood, so.
There you go.
Yeah.
But, you know, outside of the operating theatre, virtual reality's ability to con our brain means that it can also be extremely effective for psychiatric therapy. It's worked for a wide range of anxiety disorders and PTSD. A meta-analysis of 14 clinical trials, for example, found that virtual reality treatment is effective for tackling spider and flying phobias. And speaking of phobias, Li Chui Lin and I did a show with consultant psychiatrist Dr. Philip George about phobia, and he did mention the use of virtual reality.
With the early stages, you can actually then expose yourself through things, what you call images and sort of 3D sort of activities. And therapy has evolved into those things as well. So people can actually put themselves into a situation where they're actually experiencing it online. Yeah, virtual reality. And so that's come into therapy as well. So that's available online. And so people can actually try and use that first as self-help before they actually, you know, see a professional.
Are you afraid of anything? Do you have a phobia?
Insects that crawl, I guess. But all insects crawl, right? And blood, as I mentioned, which reminds me, I think there's a lot of interest in hospital dramas, right? So maybe this is something that would take that to the next level, like a reality kind, like a hospital drama in a reality setting. And speaking of VR as well, and the fact that you mentioned it's a way to con the brain, right, to hack our natural protective mechanism. It reminds me of this phrase, which I hate a lot. It's nothing to fear but fear itself. I guess there's some good qualities to it. There is some advantage, because if you can bypass that pain, then you don't need to inject yourself with drugs to go through labor, for example. But just to link it back to the first story that we did on eating, I think the thresholds are there for some reason, right? Because if we go through the world without pain, we would not even feel any injuries or any... We would not be fearful of heights or sharp edges or whatnot. Delicate balance to manage.
Yeah, that's a good point. We'll leave it at that. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. It's Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. My name is Tina Camellia, and joining me in the studio, Chua Antek, Live and Learn producer, as we discuss some of the interesting health news that captured our attention. Our last story of the day.
Fake health news. So I think everyone is familiar right now with the term fake news, post-truth, post-fact, and they were made popular because of the US elections last year, mostly used when discussing politics, but now it's encroaching into the health field as well. And a fair share of false news that came out, especially on Facebook, perpetrated by people like David Wolf, the Food Babe, otherwise known as Vani Hari, and even Gwyneth Paltrow. So why are they so influential, and how can we discern what's real and what's not?
The reality is that, you know, the individual can actually affect so much change on another individual. You don't have to be a scientist to speak science and celebrate science. And you also don't have to be a scientist to contribute to society.
So that's Dr. Abhimanyu Virakumarasivam, who was recently crowned the best science communicator at the FameLab International 2016 competition. And that quote from him came from a discussion about the importance of science communication. And he was encouraging anyone, everyone, to talk about science, to talk about health. You don't have to be an expert in it, because, for example, health is everyone's concern. We're all concerned about our health and our well-being. But, you know, some people take it a step too far and decide to spread false news. I mean, where do you get your health news from?
Exactly, because you can't talk about science if you don't have a baseline of knowledge to talk about, right? Otherwise, you're just spreading your personal biases and prejudice. I get my health news from, I think, the usual sources, BBC, The Economist, or New York Times. I rarely go on Facebook nowadays to get my news, because I feel like I should go to the news sources and get the news straight from the horse's mouth, because they will be quoting, I guess, scientists or news wires like the AP or Reuters. So if it's a domain that I do not recognize, chances are I wouldn't click on it. So that has been my principle, or that has been my modus operandi from the aftermath of the fake news. That's how I'm coping with it. How do you cope? Because I know you have a more varied way of curating news information.
I know that I live in a filter bubble as well online, just because I avoid certain... I mean, like you, I go to sources like BBC, The Guardian, sites I can trust. But at the same time, I don't give a chance to people who may have valid points just because they're not quoted on the BBC, for example. Then that's also creating a filter for myself. And maybe they have actually true things to say. So it's very hard to say with conviction that I'm an unbiased health news producer, for example. I can't say that, right. But I try my best. For example, on our show, on our daily show on health and living, I try to bring in speakers from, you know, across the board. We have mainstream healthcare professionals. We also have had alternative medicine practitioners. We've had traditional Chinese medicine practitioners. So just to have a varied kind of opinions about the same topic. For example, cancer management. We've done both the mainstream cancer management topics. We've also covered alternative care. So that's the best that I can do.
But the thing about health and science is that it's not like politics, right? There's no left and right or red, blue or green. It's either it's right or wrong. So if your point is valid and there's a consensus around it that it works, it can be replicated, eventually the mainstream media will catch on. Maybe they're more conservative in covering new ideas or new care management or therapies. But if proven, I suspect it will eventually find its way into the main page or homepage of the BBC or sites like The Guardians.
A lot of it has to do with a low level of confidence in the media right now, just because I think people are just confused, paranoid, they're frustrated, they're very anti-establishment, and they just want to go against the grain and just not go to mainstream media because it's, you know, considered untrustworthy.
So ironic, isn't it, that in an effort to get more truthful news, they go towards news that are fake. Which is, I just find so tragic. But I think it's one thing to have a healthy dose of skepticism when it comes to the news that you consume, but to distrust the establishment because it is the establishment or it's the mainstream media, I think that distrust is misplaced.
To quote actual research, for example, Zika that spread throughout the American continent last year was accompanied by another outbreak, one of rumors and false news about the disease. So researchers from the University of Wisconsin and Tulane University in the United States analyzed 200 English posts on Facebook. Using the keywords Zika and virus, the scientists searched for material published over the course of a month. And in their results, which was published in the American Journal of Infection Control, they reported that while posts published by institutions such as the World Health Organization reach 43,000 page views, misleading pages that describe Zika as a medical ploy or hoax received 530,000 page views, which is more than 10 times more. So I think we like sensationalism, so
yeah, that's a very attractive allure to conspiracy theories, isn't it? And many reasons for that. Part of it is because it's anti-establishment. You want to be different, not just like everybody else. You want to be contrarian, edgy. But I just feel like people who work in the WHO, the World Health Organization, or journalists, these are people who want to do good work, you know, they are idealistic at first, at the very least, you know.
An example of some of the contrarians, I would say. 2 years ago, for example, the food babe Vani Hari was really popular. She's an anti-chemical activist against, you know, food additives and all else that's not natural. Bear in mind, she often appears online with a face full of makeup, just to put it out there.
Is she aware of the irony? Has anyone pointed out in the comments?
Probably, but it's probably one of those things where she just ignores. She became one of the most popular voices on nutrition in mainstream media, even published a book which offered the original story of the food babe, how she left her job as a financial consultant. And despite no training in human metabolism or toxicology or environmental science, she became an unintentionally influential figure in public health. She's achieved quite a bit. She's even made Subway change their menu or something like that because of an ingredient that she couldn't pronounce that she said is also used to make yoga mats. And she says, if you're not going to eat your yoga mats, then you're not going to eat Subway, so remove this ingredient from your Subway. And Subway actually did wow. That. She's also gone after even Starbucks, for example, to remove certain ingredients in their products. But the book does little to address that she has also drawn the ire of many scientists who believe her claims are inaccurate or even dangerous, because she's making sweeping statements like there is just no acceptable level of any chemical to ingest ever, even though essentially our food, it's all chemicals.
Toxicologists often dispute that with the saying dosage makes the poison, right? And science writer Kavin Senapathy captured that concerns of many in saying that Hari exploits the scientific concerns of her followers and used this technique over and over again. I think there's a different take out there.
Yes, there's a different babe known as the science babe.
My master's degree is in forensics with a concentration in biological criminalistics and toxicology. I did my thesis on prescription opiate abuse trends. I really, really know how to read these labels carefully.
So she wrote a very strong piece on Gawker, if I'm not mistaken, where she just tried to bring down the food babe. And I think part of the reason why the food babe is not that quoted much anymore, I think it's mostly because of Yvette D'Entremont, who is an analytical chemist with a background in forensics and toxicology. She gave a very, I find this example really relatable. She wrote, "If I told you that a chemical that's used as a disinfectant used in industrial laboratory for hydrolysis reactions and can create a nasty chemical burn is also a common ingredient in salad dressing, would you panic? What if I told you I was talking about vinegar, otherwise known as acetic acid?" So, yeah, yeah. I think that it's a very interesting statement for her to kind of simplify the whole. She was able to bring down the food babe with, you know, very simple examples like this.
Yeah, because if this was said by the food babe, I would panic. I would be worried that I'm getting poisoned. But because she's a scientist, I believe her. Because if I'm going to die from vinegar, I think a lot of people would have been dying first.
And last year, we saw the rise of David Wolf, or David Avocado Wolf. For those who are not aware of who he is, he describes himself as a health, eco, nutrition and natural beauty expert, although others have called him a scam artist. He has almost 10 million likes on Facebook, and he has a much greater social media presence than Stephen Hawking and Neil deGrasse Tyson put together. Stephen Hawking, I think, has about 3.5 million likes on Facebook. Neil deGrasse Tyson, about 3.7 million likes.
Does this mean that David Avocado Wolf is a better science communicator?
He is a very convincing communicator, not necessarily a science communicator. Right. He uses, you know, those motivational posts and inspirational memes to address current issues that people would be able to connect to. And then every now and then he intersperses it with unproven health or scientific claims. So, you know, for example, he said that deer antlers are cosmic substance, which is just words. Coincidentally, he's also selling deer antlers on his website as a food supplement, although he does not claim it as a food supplement. He just says that it's a cosmic substance.
This guy also does not believe in gravity?
No, he does not believe in gravity. He thinks that gravity is a Carl Sagan idea that was sold to us on Cosmos, on PBS, deliberately to confuse us. For example, he thinks that it's the salt in the ocean that is helping the ocean not to levitate.
The reason why the oceans are salty is that's what's needed to hold the water onto the earth. If that didn't happen, the water would levitate right off the earth. That'd be the end of it.
Wow.
How much do you know about gravity and...
Well, if David Avocado Wolf is correct, then nothing at all.
Actually, the reason the ocean is salty is because the rain erodes the rocks, transporting the minerals into the oceans. That's why it's salty. And the reason fresh water in rivers and streams are not salty is because the rain replenishes the fresh water and it's flown into the ocean. So the ocean takes in all the salts and minerals. And it's gravity that actually holds the water to the earth.
But is that just science propaganda? Is that real? Can we actually verify that?
Verify the scientific truth, yeah, or verify David Wolf's
well,
claim?
See, you call it truth, but David Wolf would argue with that.
I don't know how to... See, that's why I'm not a science communicator. I wouldn't be able to...
That's how it starts, right? You just throw this question, and because it really depends on how well educated, how science literate a population is in order to refute blanket statements such as this or ignorant statements such as this.
Yeah, we need like someone like a Bill Nye who can respond to claims like this because I can't articulate it. I think I trust my science teachers because I've had 15 years of science education. I'm sure if they've been saying the same thing, they're probably right. Although people like David Wolf would claim that I've been brainwashed by mainstream propaganda. Right. So even people like Gwyneth Paltrow selling vaginal jade eggs on her website. And it's not cheap. It's $55 to $66 per jade egg.
Yeah, that's 200 plus or to 300 for each egg. And what does it do?
So she claims it balances hormones and recommends that women sleep with the egg in their vaginas.
Well, we don't have to go that far. In Malaysia, we have people selling magic panty liners that you can put on your forehead to cure fever or use on the nozzle of pump when you fill up your petrol. Though I don't know what purpose would that serve.
It's magical. It will make sure that your tank will be fuller, but you know it wouldn't cost as much. I think you can also slap this onto your wallet and you would have more money. It's like a magical panty liner. It does
Why
everything.
Panty liners? No, why not boxers?
I think the more bizarre it is, the more, again, it's, I think, sensational. It's the shock factor and people are just attracted to something that's just so flashy. Yeah. Oh, this sounds very interesting, intriguing.
And of course, it has to be an undergarment, right?
Yeah, I think sex in some way or another sells. So, I mean, how do we move forward from this? Locally, we have a lot of multi-level marketers trying to sell fake products that they claim to be able to cure cancer, to cure diabetes. But there are also a good number of people who are trying to refute that. I know of at least two Facebook pages, Pseudoscience Watch and Root of Science, which are both Malay pages, trying to educate the public about what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. And they deal mainly with MLMs and fake doctors. I think a number of cases where the Ministry of Health was able to detect fake doctors was because these two pages brought them to the ministry's attention. So they're doing really good work. They're trying to reach out to our Malaysian population and try to improve scientific literacy and try to help people to make the right decisions about their health and not fall for tricks like this. Have you ever fallen for fake health products?
I think when you are younger, you tend to trust people in uniforms or your parents, right? So if they tell you that taking this pill works or drinking that herbal tea works, so you tend to believe them. Whether or not it works, you won't know, because chances are maybe you are already healing in the first place, so the product is getting credit that it didn't deserve or credit that it didn't warrant. But that's, I think, TCM or traditional Chinese medicine. I think that's my only exposure to alternative medicine.
Mm-hmm. And I think if you have grave illnesses like cancer, for example, you're just really desperate. And if there's something that is out there that's telling you that I can cure your cancer right away, you would just grab that opportunity out of desperation.
Right, especially if whatever you're going through right now is not working.
Yeah.
Right. I have not been put in those kinds of dire circumstances before, so I wouldn't be able to relate, I guess. Mm-hmm.
So I think we could do with a little advice from a medical professional, Dr. Yong Junina, who's a consultant pediatrician and pediatric cardiologist, about what we can do when dealing with health news, especially online.
Dr. Google does not have a medical degree. That's what I always say. So seek proper advice. Listen to qualified professionals. If in doubt, ask. Ask questions. Ask your health professional. If you think your doctor doesn't have the time of day for you, look for someone who can talk to you about it. If you doubt the doctor, ask for a second opinion from another doctor. But don't just discuss amongst yourselves and come up with hypotheses. I've heard a lot of hypotheses. And when I ask for the source, it is merely conjured from a group of individuals discussing about a potential side effect. It's just like saying, if I do this, this happens. What if this were to be done? You know, without actually looking at the scientific evidence. And then they postulate and they come up with a theory. And after theorizing, they put it as a post on social media, and then it goes viral. And suddenly it becomes the gospel truth.
Of course.
But I suppose, you know, it is up to us as individuals to read up further and to actually find out whether or not such statements are true.
I think we're conflicted about what to believe and what not. And so much of our skepticism comes from the fact that maybe we think those in positions of power, those who are in charge of our health, don't really know what they're doing. Whether this distrust is founded or not founded, that's another matter altogether, right? And so stories like what you just told, that the Ministry of Health is doing good work to go and suss out fake doctors, stories like that should be encouraging that not everyone is out to get you. Mm-hmm. You don't have to feel like the world is a vast conspiracy theory.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty loaded. I mean, we're not solving the problem, but I guess we're trying our best with shows like this. Thank you so much for joining me today, Antek.
Right. Thanks, Tina. Always a pleasure talking.
You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.